Excuse me. Let's get started. Welcome, everybody, to the last session on the last day of Tech Ed Europe 2013. Has everybody enjoyed the show this far? It's been great? Been good? Good deal. Thank you all for attending. You guys are definitely troopers to come to my session on the last day, the last session on the last day, so that's been great. I had the honor of doing that at Tech Ed North America a couple of weeks ago. Basically asked us to turn off the lights on the way out, so it's good. I think they're saving the best for last. We're going to talk about direct access in Windows Server 2012. Now, pretty much all week you've been getting pounded with information about Windows Server 2012 R2. There are no real changes. Let me correct that. There are no substantive changes in direct access in Windows Server 2012 R2. So everything that we're going to talk about here applies to Server 2012 R2. I could just edit this session and just put an R2 on it, and everything would be fine. So no worries there, no changes that you have to worry about. You're not missing out on anything. So before we get started, I like to start off the talk talking about remote access in general, at least at a high level, and some of the challenges that it poses. I have personal experience having deployed remote access solutions for some of the largest corporations in the world. I also have experience managing remote access solutions for very large companies in the United States in a previous job. And so I know those pain points intimately. Remote access VPN can be challenging to manage. You have to deploy client software on the endpoints. You have to manage that software, the configuration. Your help desk is going to get a lot of calls because, the VPN doesn't work. I can't connect. Why doesn't my password work? When I am connected, why every time I try to connect to a resource am I getting access denied because I have password sync issues? A lot of challenges around the operational features. DNS name resolution sometimes can be a kind of a pain point with legacy VPN solutions as well. And I think that you'll see that direct access is going to simplify and really make a lot of those things better. Also, from another kind of point that I think direct access addresses, and that is one that systems management folks, we prepare our laptop images. And we prepare them, get them all set up, get them all pristine, everything's installed, configured, apps installed, everything up to date. We hand it to that field salesperson. They hit the road, and the laptop just goes off the grid, right? The only time we hear from them is when there's a problem. Something doesn't work. They'll come back to the office. They'll try to dial in via VPN, what have you. And then we find out that, well, they installed some third-party software on there that was Trojaned, or they turned off the firewall, or they turned off antivirus. And we have a lot of problems with that. We don't know if the systems are being updated on when they're out on the internet. We have no idea what state they're in, and so we lack a lot of visibility into our mobile clients when they leave our corporate networks. And so direct access, I think you're going to find, is going to ease some of those challenges as well. So for our session, what I want to do is start off with a discussion of what direct access is and kind of explain it at a high level. Some of you may not be familiar with it. Talk about the benefits of direct access and what do we get out of deploying direct access to our clients. We'll talk about what's new in Windows Server 2012 direct access, and I could just put R2 there, it would be the same discussion, over previous versions as well. We'll talk about the components that make up direct access, the limitations of direct access as well, because it does come with some drawbacks. I'm going to paint a really rosy picture about how awesome this solution is, and then I'm going to kind of pull the rug out from under you a little bit and say, here's the caveats, here's the asterisk, though, so you'll understand those up front. We'll talk briefly about how direct access works. I'll give a demonstration. We'll actually deploy direct access right here on my laptop in a matter of minutes. You'll see how quick and easy it is to deploy. And then I'd like to wrap up with some quick discussion about the security considerations of direct access. And ultimately, the conversation is really the same for any remote access solution, but I always feel like we should talk about those types of things when we have any remote access solution. So what is direct access? It is the next generation of remote access that provides always-on, seamless, and transparent remote corporate network connectivity for our managed clients. Unlike traditional VPN solutions, it does support bi-directional connectivity. So that means not only does the user have the ability to access corporate data and applications that are on premises remotely, I have the ability as a systems administrator on premises to reach out and touch my direct access clients anytime they are connected. So that's extremely important, and it's a key differentiator between VPN. And that's one of the reasons why when you talk to me and you see a lot of my writing, I tend not to refer this to this as a VPN. It's kind of a pet peeve of mine. Direct access VPN is kind of an oxymoron. Those are two different things in my view. Now, why do I say that? Well, if it helps if you have a comparison, or if I'll draw a comparison between direct access and what I call legacy VPN, because VPN is basically old school now. VPNs, again, they suffer from a lot of challenges. They're intrusive. They're invasive. They require the user to actively initiate the connection. We're leaving it up to the user. So the user has to decide, I need access to data or applications on the corporate network, and so now I need to light up my VPN client, enter my credentials or my OTP, and then connect to the network and do my work. Oh, and by the way, if I get up and move and drop that connection, now I have to reinitiate the connection. And now the user experience tends to be real clunky with most of the most VPNs today. And fundamentally, when we're talking about VPN and legacy VPN in particular, it's a model by which the remote user connects to the corporate network. He or she has to decide, I need to connect to the corporate network, and they do so on their time frame and on their schedule. Now, if you contrast this with direct access, again, is seamless and transparent. It requires no action from the user. The user doesn't have to do anything. The user will be automatically connected in the background to your corporate network anytime they have an internet connection. So if they have a connection to the internet, even if they are not logged on, they are connected to the corporate network. And they're connected securely because it's authenticated using the computer account as well as certificates. In this paradigm, I like to think of it as extending the corporate network to the user. And if you think about it in that kind of frame of mind, it gives you an idea of the types of things that you can do with this pretty compelling remote access solution. Now, some of the benefits to deploying direct access from an end user perspective: much, much more streamlined experience. Your users access data, applications, and resources on the corporate network in the same way outside the network as they do inside the network. So however they get to your intranet applications when they're sitting in their cubicle is the same way they access that application using the same host names and the same URLs at a coffee shop, at home, at a meeting, at a hotel, it doesn't matter. They access them in the same exact way. So talk about reducing that pain point. You don't have to instruct your users to use the FQDN or the IP address when you're on the VPN because something's not working. You just use the URL wherever you are. As long as you have internet connection, you'll get to your corporate network. So, of course, this all results in increased productivity, and ultimately, another bullet point I could put on there is reduces help desk calls. So if it works, it works, and the solution, again, much more user-friendly from a operational perspective. Now, the challenge with deploying a remote access solution or upgrading or even replacing an existing solution is that oftentimes just making things better for the user doesn't get our projects funded. However, from an administrative perspective, there are some compelling reasons to look at deploying a solution like this. Your direct access clients are always managed. Since they have access or connectivity to the corporate network, anytime they are connected to the internet, it means they are always talking to your domain controllers. They're always talking to your systems management servers. And so from that perspective and from a compliance perspective, we kind of reduce or eliminate that blind spot for our mobile devices. When they leave, I can still manage them, and I can still monitor and report on them. I know they're getting the latest group policy. I know if there is a systems update that I want to push out, that I can push that out to them. So in terms of compliance, it's outstanding. And, of course, reduced administration costs. It means that I have fewer problems with my mobile machines when they are direct access clients because I have much more improved ability to manage them when they are on the road. Now, direct access has been around for a number of years. It's not a brand new technology. It was actually first came out in Windows Server 2008 R2. It was a feature of Windows Server 2008 R2. Direct access was an excellent idea, but it suffered from the challenge that it was extremely difficult to deploy and had a very high bar in terms of infrastructure requirements to deploy it. So one question I like to ask when I do these sessions is, how many people, has anybody, show of hands, anybody deploy direct access with Windows Server 2008 R2? Anyone? So a couple people. Wow, this is actually the most, and it's probably because we're here in Europe. One of the biggest challenges with Server 2008 R2 is that for direct access to work, it required IPv6 to be deployed on your intranet. So that was a showstopper for a lot of people. And, you know, rolling out IPv6 on your intranet is not a trivial effort, something that takes a lot of time and effort, planning. Oftentimes, it requires changing hardware. We have to have routers and switches and network management thing, IDS, IPS, firewalls, all have to be able to handle IPv6 traffic as well. So that was kind of a showstopper for Server 2008 R2. Now, in 2010, the Forefront team released the Forefront Unified Access Gateway, and with the Forefront UAG 2010 came the support for the remote access or the direct access gateway role. So it supported serving as your reverse proxy, an SSL application proxy, as well as the direct access gateway. And it brought along a couple of technologies that kind of reduced the some of the barriers to adoption. First of all, it came with a couple of translation protocols that eliminated the requirement to have IPv6 running on your intranet. So at that point, we saw the adoption rate go up significantly. Forefront UAG brought along its own challenges. So although it did make things better, it at the times kind of made things worse, because UAG, if you've ever worked with that, is not a trivial system to install, configure, manage, and maintain. It also required licenses that were kind of expensive. So while it made things better in one aspect, it kind of made things a little bit worse in the other. So kind of a net no gain in my book. But ultimately, we come to Windows Server 2012 and Windows Server 2012 R2, and they've really, really done a great job of making it easy to deploy and reducing a lot of those infrastructure requirements and putting everything in the box. It doesn't require any additional software other than enabling a role in Windows Server 2012 and then lighting up your clients that way. So what's new in Server 2012 Direct Access or Server 2012 R2 Direct Access? Honestly, I could talk for an hour and a half or 2 hours on just about what's new in this release. The Windows team did a fantastic job of adding features and capabilities to this solution. Unfortunately, we don't want to be here for 3 hours, so I'm forced to kind of give you the high-level overview of what's new, and so I want to go through just some of what I believe are the key points to what's new in Server 2012 and Server 2012 R2 Direct Access. Easier to deploy, infinitely easier to deploy. You're going to see when I do the demonstration later that we're going to be able to do it in mere minutes. It's actually pretty simple and straightforward. The network placement is much more flexible. Direct access in Server 2008 R2 and Forefront UAG had a hard requirement to have public IPv4 addresses assigned to its external network interface, and you had to have two consecutive public IPv4 addresses. Now, IPv4 address space is depleting, but ultimately we can still obtain them. That's not the biggest challenge. The biggest challenge, and one of the most significant challenges we had, is that the direct access server needs to be domain joined, and having that conversation with a CIO and telling them, hey, I need to put a domain join Windows server directly connected to the internet, was not an easy conversation. Now, it was made easier and more palatable by the fact that we had Forefront TMG running on the box. And Forefront TMG, of course, is an enterprise-class firewall, common criteria, EAL4+ certified, long-proven track record of providing highly reliable, highly secure service on a direct edge facing system. So most of the time we could win that argument. We don't need to make that argument anymore in Server 2012 R2 or R2012 because it supports deploying behind a NAT device now. So we don't have to place it directly on the edge, directly on the internet. We can place it behind an existing border router or edge firewall performing NAT. So moot point, we don't have to fight that battle. It performs better. They've made a lot of improvements in terms of performance in this new edition. It supports a single IPsec tunnel now, and I put an asterisk there because it supports a single IPsec tunnel in some deployments. There are some features that if you enable them, you do have to revert to the two IPsec tunnel mode configuration. But if you have a simple configuration, you can get away with a single IPsec tunnel. And that greatly reduces the overhead and improves or increases the number of users that you can get on a single direct access server. There were some improvements made to the IP-HTTPS IPv6 transition protocol as well, and we'll talk about transition protocols later. But IP-HTTPS suffered from some performance drawbacks because it provided encryption for a communication stream that was already encrypted. So we were double encrypting for no real gain or benefit other than just killing CPU cycles and reducing our bandwidth. So they made that improvement, and so that's a fantastic improvement in Server 2012. Much more scalable as well. They've added load balancing out of the box. You don't have to deploy Forefront UAG any longer to get the load balancing capabilities. So I can create up to an 8-node cluster so I can have local site high availability for my direct access solution. Also, we have a geographic redundancy option. And this was something that was sorely lacking from the previous versions in that I could only have a gateway in one location and home clients to that. And if I had another gateway, the clients that were home to my first gateway would never know about the second gateway. Now, in Server 2012, with geographic redundancy, I can create multiple entry points. So I could have one in Los Angeles, another one in New York, and another one here in Madrid. And my clients will be able to intelligently select the closest gateway. And if that gateway goes down, they will automatically establish a connection to a remaining gateway that's online. And I'll point out that the caveat there is that the clients have to be Windows 8 to take advantage of that feature. You can still support Windows 7 clients, but they don't support that dynamic entry point location like Windows 8 do. And then, of course, management. Now, it's just a much, much better solution in terms of management capabilities. The management or the monitoring, the reporting, and the diagnostics features are all much improved in this solution, and it's much easier and much more intuitive to use. And PowerShell, full PowerShell support for everything, installation, configuration, client troubleshooting, all sorts of good PowerShell in there as well. So if you haven't gotten enough PowerShell this week, here's some more PowerShell for you. And we'll actually install the role using PowerShell here a little bit. So direct access, one of the things that I like to make sure that people understand is that direct access is not a protocol. Rather, it is a collection of technologies and protocols that are used to make our always-on remote access solution. So we start with Windows Server 2012 and the remote access role, which we will install. On the client side, we're going to use Windows 8 Enterprise. It does support Windows 7 as long as it's Enterprise or Ultimate Edition, and there are some additional configuration changes you have to make to be able to support Windows 7 clients. It relies on IPv6 for its transport and IPsec for security, so it does require certificates so that we can establish our IPsec tunnels. And then we use Active Directory and Group Policy to centrally administer and deploy the settings for our clients. We actually do that from AD and do that with Group Policy objects. The Group Policy objects are built for us using the deployment wizard, as you'll see later when we get to the demonstration. Again, as I mentioned, it does use certificates, and sometimes this throws up a red flag. People panic and say, oh gosh, I don't have a PKI. I don't want to know anything about PKI. PKI is optional in Windows Server 2012 R2. However, it is still strongly recommended. The solution will use self-signed certificates, but from a security perspective, self-signed certificates are bad. Self-signed certificates don't provide me much in the way non-repudiation. So in other words, I don't know who issued this. There's no difference between this, my self-signed certificate and your self-signed certificate, so there's no way to understand that. In addition, the self-signed certificate that they use uses a pretty weak algorithm, I think. It uses RSA-4, RSA, but it uses a 1024-bit key. So I think the general recommendation today is that we need to move to 2048-bit keys. This is still using a 1024-bit key. So we recommend that you deploy certificates if at all possible. A PKI is required, however, if you're going to support Windows 7 clients. So if you plan to support Windows 7 clients for your direct access deployment, then you must have a PKI, so you can't get around that. Direct Access uses a component called the Network Location Server, and it sounds really complex, but it's really nothing more than a web server with an SSL certificate on it that we can use kind of almost like a homing beacon. The client, when it's on the intranet, will send a request to the Network Location Server. If it gets a response, it knows it's on the CorpNet. If it doesn't get a response, it knows that it's outside, and it will know to bring up the IPsec tunnels and do some more stuff. And so we'll talk about that a little bit later. In previous versions, the Network Location Server was up to you to install and configure, so you had to deploy that in your environment. In Server 2012, we've taken that out of your hands, and the Network Location Server is actually installed as a part of the role, and then it's configured using the Direct Access Deployment Wizard, so it's actually on box. We don't have to do anything. We don't need anything extra for that. DNS 6-4 and NAT 6-4 are included and configured out of the box. And again, these are the protocols or the translation protocols that we use to allow our direct access clients to talk to our intranet resources that have only IPv4 running on them. So why do we need that and why is that necessary? Well, it's because the direct access client speaks only IPv6. So from a client perspective, this is an IPv6 only solution. Any communication that it attempts to make with CorpNet is via IPv6. And so we're going to talk about in the next slide or two about those different transition protocols that we use. But ultimately, once it gets to the direct access server, if I need to talk to a resource that does not have IPv6, I need to translate my DNS queries to Quad A records and get an IPv6 address back, and then send that to the NAT 6-4 service to have it translate it to IPv4 so that I can talk to my systems on my intranet that are not IPv6 enabled. We make use of something called the name resolution policy table as well, and that's on the client side. And the reason we need that is we need it for policy-based name resolution routing. So when we configure the client, we want the client to understand that you have an internet connection for which you can get to the rest of the world, but we want you to use a specific DNS server for any name resolution requests for our corporate namespace. And so when it sees a request for in corp.example.com, don't send it to the DNS servers that you got from wherever you got your IP address on the adapter. Send it to a very specific DNS server, and that's actually a DNS server service that's running on the direct access gateway that performs that translation. So it understands that it needs to talk to that to get those host names from our internal CorpNet, because obviously the external public DNS doesn't know anything about our internal namespace. Lastly, we make use of the Windows Firewall with Advanced Security. Specifically, we need the connection security rules. The connection security rules in the Windows Firewall are what allow us to build those IPsec tunnels and securely connect to CorpNet. First of all, and this is important information here, is that you must have the Windows Firewall running on the clients and the server. So I talk to a lot of customers who run into that challenge where DirectX doesn't work, because by policy, they turn off the Windows Firewall on all their servers. This requires that the Windows Firewall be running because we are using it to build those IPsec tunnels. It doesn't mean that you can't install another firewall, but this one must be running and not be disabled. So, as I had mentioned earlier, direct access does require IPv6 end-to-end. And I'll probably say this a couple of more times throughout the session because I need to drive this point home. And it's important to understand how the client is communicating to CorpNet, because there's going to be some caveats a little bit later, and we'll talk about those. So the first thing generally that people tend to get concerned about is, okay, well, I don't have IPv6 running on my direct access server facing the public internet. or on my border router or edge firewall. No need. We don't need that. Also, with regards to the client's probably going to be on the IPv4 internet, probably not going to be on the IPv6 internet. Not a problem either. What we're going to do is we're going to leverage something called IPv6 transition technologies, and we're going to use those to tunnel our IPv6 traffic from the client over the IPv4 internet so they can get to the direct access gateway. But ultimately, it's still IPv6 traffic. It's just using these transition technologies. Now, the first IPv6 transition technology that we're going to use is a technology called 6-to-4. And with 6-to-4, anytime the client has a public IPv4 address, it will use the 6-to-4 transition technology. And 6-to-4 uses IP protocol 41 for its transport. So it will get a 6-to-4 adapter, it will assign itself a 6-to-4 IPv6 address, and we will tunnel that traffic over the IPv4 internet in 6-to-4. Now, if the client is behind a NAT and has a private IP address, 6-to-4 is not going to work. So the next transition protocol to use is called Teredo. Teredo is used anytime the client has a private IPv4 address. So if they're behind a NAT and they have an IPv4 address from the RFC 1918 private address space, 6-to-4 will fail to initialize, but Teredo will initialize. And so Teredo uses UDP for its transport, specifically UDP port 3544. All well and fine until your client is behind a NAT with a firewall that doesn't allow outbound UDP or outbound UDP 3544. So in that case, we have to fall back to something called IP-HTTPS. And this is pretty intuitive. We're going to tunnel our IPv6 packets inside of HTTP and then protect that with SSL or TLS. And again, used any time that 6-to-4 or Teredo are not available to us. It is the transition protocol of last resort. This will almost always work because if you have access to the internet, you probably have access to TCP port 443 outbound, and so this protocol will work almost ubiquitously. One of the drawbacks to this is that, of course, we're taking traffic, IPsec traffic, that is encrypted, and encrypting it again with SSL and TLS. And as I'd mentioned earlier, we've made some improvements, or the Windows team has made some improvements with regards to this transition protocol in particular to use now null encryption. So we still authenticate, so we're checking the certificate and making sure that we trust it, but we're now not double encrypting, so our performance is exceptionally better with Windows 8 clients on a Windows Server 2012 direct access server. If you are to support Windows 7 clients, they will fall back to the old behavior of double encrypting. There is a way actually to work around that, and I'll talk a little bit about that. I'm documenting it as we speak, so if you watch my website, my blog, I'll probably post something about that soon, about how to do that. It requires a hardware load balancer, but ultimately we have a way to kind of work around that. So if you have to deploy a lot of Windows 7 clients, you either need to offload it or just plan accordingly and understand that I'm not going to be able to get as many clients on the box as I would with Windows 8 clients. Now, 6-to-4, Teredo, IP-HTTPS are all direct access client transition protocols. Those are all used for the client to tunnel its traffic to the direct access server over the public internet. From the intranet, if I'm on a system that has IPv4 and I need to talk to a direct access client, I must talk via IPv6. Well, how do I do that? The ISOTAP transition protocol is what we're going to use on the intranet. So ISOTAP stands for Intra-Site Automatic Tunnel Addressing Protocol. And once the client is configured to use an ISOTAP adapter, it will assign itself an ISOTAP address, and then I will be able to tunnel my IPv6 packets over my IPv4 intranet. So it's used to enable the manage out scenario. I can actually, from my intranet on premises, I can actually reach out and initiate a connection to a internet connected direct access client. I might want to do that because I want to proactively push out software. I may want to do some troubleshooting, and I want to initiate an RDP session, a help desk engineer, or something like that. So there's a number of different scenarios in which ISOTAP is helpful. When you install and configure direct access, it will configure itself as an ISOTAP router. When you, that's not the only thing that needs to be done. You also need to configure DNS to support ISOTAP. So to do that, you actually put a record in your internal DNS called ISOTAP, and it resolves to the IPv4 address that's assigned to the internal network interface on your direct access server. You also need to remove ISOTAP from the global query block list, because by default, ISOTAP and WPAD are the two records that are always blocked on any modern DNS server. So you actually have to explicitly tell DNS to respond to ISOTAP records, and you do that using PowerShell. So before we continue, one of the things that I like to do is talk a little bit about ISOTAP in a little more detail, because as good as ISOTAP might sound, it's quite problematic, and we actually recommend that you don't deploy this. Now, from experience, when we used to deploy direct access with Server 2008 R2 and even with Forefront UAG, the kind of standard operating procedure was install ISOTAP router. It's already installed, configure DNS, and we just did it. What we found is that we kept hitting our heads against the wall, because every time we would do this, it would be problematic, and we'd have to turn it off or make serious concessions. It was a real challenge. It has some serious limitations that lead us to say to recommend not deploying it, and we'll talk about those. So first of all, ISOTAP is global in scope. Any system that can resolve the ISOTAP record to that IPv4 address will install and configure an ISOTAP tunnel adapter, assign itself an ISOTAP address, and start communicating. That freaks network people out. It also has a tendency to cause problems, because if I open up a web browser, for example, on a client with an ISOTAP adapter, and I resolve an address on the internet to an IPv6 address, it will attempt, or it may attempt, to contact the internet through my ISOTAP tunnel, which points to my direct access in the subnet, not the internet. So it either fails, or you have to wait a long time before it times out and then tries IPv4. So real challenges there. It caused some other brokenness as well. There's been some updates in the operating systems that have made this better, but ultimately it was a real challenge, and we basically changed our thinking there, and we deploy it as we need. Also, this is a real pet peeve of mine, is that ISOTAP basically flips the OSI model upside down. Now I have lower layer protocols depending on upper layer protocols to work. So if DNS doesn't work, if name resolution is not working correctly, I can't route traffic, and that just irritates me. So I don't like that dependency. It's just fundamentally backwards. There's also a lack of robust monitoring and management tool for a service that's pretty essential. Generally, the way it works is if it stops working, somebody tells you because they can't connect. It's very difficult to monitor and manage. So real challenge with that. So again, all of those things lead to, based on our experience, lead to us saying, hey, don't use ISOTAP. There are better ways. We can still get this functionality. And it's funny, because our number one recommendation now is deploy IPv6. Well, we're kind of back to that square one, where people didn't want to deploy v6 for the solution in the first place. Well, if you can't deploy IPv6, and we understand that you can't, but this is the general recommendation, even if you have to deploy it to one or two or a small subset of workstations, not your whole internet, you can make this work. There are some other workarounds. So first of all, you can restrict ISOTAP to specific hosts. So if you can't deploy IPv6, consider ISOTAP, but consider restricting it to a very specific set of hosts. And one of the things that we learned was that enabling ISOTAP for everybody was useless, because we had like one or three or five workstations that ultimately needed this connectivity. Most of the time it was a management server or a management subnet or one or two servers that needed to maybe be able to initiate communication out. And so what we do is we light up ISOTAP on those specific hosts. You can target ISOTAP at hosts using group policy. You can do so individually at the command line using PowerShell and NetSH as well. And you can, if you like to revert to the Stone Age, you actually can just add a host record, a record in the host file to make ISOTAP work on an individual workstation. Obviously, the best way to do this is group policy, because it's much more scalable, but ultimately you have some other options as well. So, we've talked about how great and awesome direct access is. Now I have to tell you, it's not for everybody, and here are the drawbacks, right? So here are all the warts. Now, direct access, again, does come with some limitations. I think the most restrictive limitations come out of the client support. So from a client support perspective, to enable direct access, you must have Windows 8 Enterprise Edition, Windows 7 Enterprise Edition, or Windows 7 Ultimate. So it's not supported on any other operating system. So that means Windows 8 Pro and so forth. These systems must be domain joined as well. The direct access server must also be domain joined. I don't think that's necessarily a drawback. I think the fact that it's limited only to the enterprise editions is more restrictive than anything else. But ultimately, you've been warned. In terms of non-supported clients, obviously anything that's not on the supported clients list, right? So Windows 8 Professional does not work with direct access. You can try to deploy it. It will not work. Trust me, I've tried. It doesn't work with anything older like Vista or XP or anything like that, or anything that's on the supported clients list that is not domain joined. So the direct access clients must be joined to the domain. From a client compatibility side, also there are some challenges as well. So not all applications work over the direct access tunnels. Since direct access is an IPv6 only solution and uses IPv6 as its transport exclusively, if you have applications that are leveraging protocols that have IPv4 addresses embedded in them, they will not work. For example, SIP, FTP, I think Citrix, and it's been a while since I've worked with Citrix, but I know the ICA file used to come back with an IPv4 address in it. You may be able to change that. If you can change it to a host name or an FQDN, that's the way to go. But any protocol with an embedded IPv4 address or any application that has a hard-coded IPv4 address in it. So if I attempt to connect at the command line via telnet to an IPv4 address, that will not work. I have to use a name. So I have to use a name. It has to resolve to an IPv6 address. And again, DNS64 and NAT64 take care of that translation if I'm attempting to talk to a client or an intranet host that does not have IPv6 running on it. Also, any IP protocol communication will not work as well. I had a customer that wanted to use PPTP, so which uses GRE, IP protocol, an IP protocol. To communicate to a test lab that was on their internal intranet. That's how they communicated to this test lab, how they provided isolation. Test lab was only accessible internally using a VPN client from their clients. They tried to use it over direct access. Doesn't work. Again, IP protocol communication doesn't work either. So let's talk a little bit about how direct access works. So when the client is on the intranet, the client first assumes that it's not connected to the intranet, and it will attempt to establish an SSL or an HTTPS connection to the network location server. So it looks it up in DNS, attempts to connect to it, and if it responds, everything's good, it's happy, it says, okay, well, I got a response back from my network location server. I'm on the intranet. I'm on the corpnet. The client then lights up the domain profile in the Windows firewall with advanced security. And then the name resolution policy table is then disabled because it's on the intranet. I'm going to send all of my name resolution requests right to the DNS servers configured on my adapter because I'm on the corpnet. I'm on the intranet. So at that point, there's no need for direct access tunnels because, again, I'm internal. I don't need to tunnel back to the network. I'm on the network. So if the client is now on the intranet, the first thing it's going to do is it's assumed it's not connected to the intranet, and it's going to attempt to contact the network location server. The network location server is exempted from the name resolution policy table. So anytime the client tries to resolve the name of the network location server, it will do so directly to the DNS servers that are configured on its adapter. So that's going to go out to the internet, in this case. It's going to attempt to resolve that name, and it's not even going to get a name back, right? So it's not going to be able to connect. It won't get a name. It won't connect. And at that point, it's going to either initiate the public or the private Windows Firewall with Advanced Security profile. When that happens, the name resolution policy table gets enabled. And the name resolution policy table says, hey, for this namespace, corp.example.com, send your request to this specific DNS server, and that DNS server happens to be on the other side of our IPsec tunnels. So as soon as the client starts looking for a domain controller, it does a name query looking for those service records. the tunnel says, okay, well, I have to light up because this resource is on the other side of the IPsec tunnel. So then those tunnels come up, I get my name back, I talk to my domain controller, and I'm good to go. So at that point, I'm connected, everybody's happy, and we can do the happy dance. So let's talk briefly about implementing direct access. It is not terribly difficult. We're going to show you how to do it here shortly. It takes mere minutes. Installing the remote access feature can be done in a number of different ways. We can do that using the GUI. We can also use PowerShell, and that's how I prefer to do it, and that's how we're going to do it in our demonstration here. And you do that using this command. So install Windows feature, remote access, we include the management tools, and then initiate a restart. Once you've restarted, or once the system's come back online, we'll then configure remote access, and we'll do that using the simplified deployment model in my demo here. The simplified deployment model is used in certain scenarios in which we don't need advanced capabilities. So the simplified deployment scenario works unless you want to support Windows 7 clients, unless you need to use NAP integration, or you want to use dynamic passwords, OTP, or you want to do advanced features like multi-site or things like that. So there are some scenarios in which the simplified deployment model won't work, but I'm going to show that to you because it's quick and easy. Ultimately, you can find some other information about deploying in a complex deployment. So complex deployment uses a different wizard, and I'll actually show you where that's at as well. So let's kick over and do a demonstration then. So here running on my machine, I have this is a domain join Windows Server 2012 server. Domain join, and basically done nothing more than just join it to the domain. So I've not installed any software outside of just configuring it and joining it to my domain. Now, to launch the remote access installation, you would actually, if you're going to use the GUI, you would actually go to add roles or features and walk through the installation as you normally would. We're going to select role-based. We'll choose our server. And here is where we're going to select remote access. At this point, it's going to ask you, do we want to add these additional features? Of course, we need them. You'll see that there's some group policy management components. There's some remote access tools. Also on here, you'll see that there's a web server that's installed, and that web server is there to support the network location server. So ultimately, we're just going to choose add features, and we'll add all of those components, and we'll choose next. And at this point, you can pretty much next out of this until you get to the end. And we could click install and fire this off. But I just want to show you how much easier it is, actually, if we were just to use the PowerShell. So we'll open a elevated PowerShell. Oops, did I get that? Yes. Must run as an administrator. Great. And easy enough, we will install the Windows feature, remote access is the role that we want to install. We will include the management tools for our purposes, and then we will also, if it needs or requires, we'll issue a restart. It's important also to point out that we're doing this with PowerShell. We're installing it with the remote management tools and so forth. In Server 2012, the direct access and the remote access role is fully supported on Server Core and also minimal server interface. In a production environment, that is the desired deployment. Normally, what you would do is you would set this up, and this is the way I kind of do this, is I set it up with the GUI. Do everything. Once it's up and running and working, then I will remove the GUI using the PowerShell and then manage it remotely entirely. That way, you don't have the additional overhead. You don't have the attack surface. Especially important if you're gonna put this directly on the internet, which is generally not recommended anymore since it supports installing behind a border router or edge firewall. So in those cases, recommend that you deploy this behind an existing solution. to provide that level of security. One important point about that is that we talked about those IPv6 transition protocols earlier. Anytime we deploy direct access behind a border router or edge firewall using NAT, the only protocol, the transition protocol that we can leverage is IP-HTTPS. So keep that in mind. Edge deployments will support 6-4 and Teredo. And from a performance perspective for Windows 7 clients, it's much better. So if you're going to deploy this behind a NAT, and if you plan on supporting a lot of Windows 7 clients, do some testing. And ultimately, I think the scalability of the solution is going to be somewhat limited. And again, make sure that you watch my website, because I'm getting ready to publish something about how you can actually leverage a hardware load balancer to kind of ease that pain. Great, so we've installed the role. So we'll come back to the Server Manager dashboard. And now in the upper right-hand corner, you will see the little yellow exclamation point. Whenever you see that, you can click on it. And what's going to ask you is it's going to basically say, there are some post-deployment configuration things that I need to do. So if I were to click on the Getting Started wizard here, this will walk me through the simplified deployment model. It's going to ask me a couple of questions, and it's going to deploy direct access. If you need to support things like NAP or multi-site or Windows 7 clients, then this is not the wizard for you. In that case, you would actually want to open the Remote Access Management Console. And again, so if you're going to support any of these complex deployment scenarios, then what you would need to do is actually run this wizard. So it doesn't show up in the Server Manager console. You would actually have to open the Remote Access Management console here and find this Remote Access wizard. So this is the Getting Started wizard. It should be the Simplified Deployment wizard, but ultimately that's the one we want to use. But again, for you guys, if you're going to deploy this with any of those complex requirements, then you'll need to use this wizard. For my purposes of the demonstration, we're going to use the quick and simple method. It does allow you to deploy both direct access and VPN, as well as just direct access only or VPN only. And this is an important distinction here, is that in this version of direct access, it actually supports coexistence with RRAS VPN. So in previous versions, it did not support that. Now you can actually deploy a single solution to support direct access and VPN. Why would you want VPN? Non-managed clients, right? So if you're going to support XP and Vista, XP and Vista, or Windows 8 Pro, Windows 7 Pro, anything that doesn't support direct access, but you still want to provide remote access for, we still support client-based VPN out of the box with PPTP, L2TP over IPsec, SSTP, and IPv2. So it's a great VPN server as well. In addition, not a bad idea to have another way into your network if you make a configuration change that cuts off your direct access clients. So they're going to need a way to get back to the corpnet to get group policy if you've made some changes that broke them. So in this case, we're just going to choose direct access only, but understand that you can use this as your unified remote access solution. So we click on Deploy Direct Access. It's going to ask us a couple of things here. The first thing it's going to ask us is, what is the topology? So how do you want to deploy this? This wizard is also intelligent in that it looks at your network configuration and gives you the choices that are pertinent or that are applicable to your particular deployment. So for example, if I had one network adapter in this box and it had an IPv4 address, it would not give me the option to deploy it on the edge. So that would be grayed out. In this case, I have two network adapters. The external network adapter has an IPv4, a public IPv4 address assigned it, so that is an option for me. And that's the deployment that I'm going to use here. So I'm going to deploy this on the edge. It's going to ask me for the public name that the clients are going to connect to. So I'm going to enter, for my cases here, this is da.richardhinks.com. It's important to understand that this FQDN or this host name needs to be in your public DNS, and it needs to resolve to the public IPv4 address of the outside interface of your direct access server, or if it's behind a border router or edge firewall, its external IPv4 address, and then you would have an ACL and a NAT rule that would forward that traffic to the direct access server. So we'll choose next. And at this point, it looks like we're done. I could click finish here and move on. However, I need to make a couple of changes. One of them is because this is a lab environment, and the other one is just a good idea and a best practice. So yeah, I'm going to click here. It says click here to edit the wizard settings. So it's got its settings ready to deploy, but I'm going to choose click here. And it's going to bring up this remote access review window, and it's going to allow me to review and potentially change any of the settings that it is going to deploy for direct access. So you can see my GPO settings here, my remote clients, remote access server, and so forth. What I'm particularly interested in here is the targeting for the remote clients. So by default, you'll see that enable direct access for mobile computers only is enabled. When this option is enabled, what it does is it uses a WMI filter to restrict or control the application of group policy to only computers that have specific types of hardware. So in other words, it's a WMI filter that's looking for mobile hardware, right? So mobile device. This would work fine if I had a laptop. Unfortunately, here in my little test lab, demo lab, I'm just using a virtual machine. So if I were to roll out with this deployment option checked, it wouldn't apply and it wouldn't work because my hardware is not a laptop. It's not a mobile computer. So that would actually not work. So I have to uncheck this option. Now the next thing it's going to do is it's going to complain and say, you know, now you're going to deploy this to all of the computers in your domain. Not a good idea, right? I don't want this to go out to all of my file and print servers and my every server in my domain and all of my workstations. So in this case, I'm going to remove the domain computers, and I'm actually going to add a group that I've already created. So I created a group called Direct Access Clients in my domain. It's a security group. I've added the computer account of my Direct Access Client to this group. And now we're going to use group policy and target this security group for the application of group policy. So all of my direct access clients that I wanted to have that capability would need to be in this group. And this is, again, for the lab, it's a good idea. It has to be there because my virtual machine isn't a laptop. But ultimately, this is a best practice because it's the best way to target rather than hit everybody and try to filter using group policy. So we'll choose next. Now, this is interesting here. So I click next because that's the only option, and it's asking me for more information here. And intuitively, you would think I need to enter something into these fields. Take my word for it, based on experience, you don't have to enter anything in here. The wizard's actually going to do that later. You do, however, need to add something in this field, the help desk email address. I can leave this blank, and it would work. The problem is that on the client side, there's a wonderful little log collection utility that will not work unless I put something there. So even if I have no intention of emailing it, I can't even use it unless I put something in here. So even if you don't want to use anything real, you can use something bogus if you want, but ultimately something that looks like an email address needs to be in this field. You also have the option here to allow direct access clients to use local name resolution. If I select this option, it will allow the client to basically turn off direct access. So ultimately, that's up to you if you want them to do that. There's no real reason not to, ultimately, or to enable that. So I never do unless I get a specific request to do that. So I'll choose finish. It's going to take me back to this review console. And at this point, I'm good. You'll see that it's going to build some group policy objects. There are objects that get applied or policies that get applied to the server as well as the clients. So keep that in mind. So we'll choose OK and finish. And at this point, it's going to walk through creating those group policy objects. The wizard will deploy those objects to Active Directory. Also important to point out that you, if you're the administrator installing and configuring direct access, must have access to AD. If you do not, no worries, you can actually export those group policy objects to files. You can give those to your AD administrators if you lack that permission. and then you can have them deploy them to Active Directory on your behalf. That process is a little clunky and a little kludgy. Ultimately, I like to say either get administrative access or have somebody from the domain admins group come over here and run through the wizard for you. So, but it is possible to manage that. So, just about done. Great. We like big green checkbox, especially in live demonstrations. That's always good. So everything was installed and configured correctly. So I'm going to choose Close. And at that point, it's going to take me back to my remote access management console. And normally, had I not been playing in here before, it would actually take me to the dashboard. And the first thing you'll notice in the dashboard here is the configuration status shows unavailable. And the reason for that is because I just deployed the policy for the clients and the server to Active Directory. So it's going to take a minute for those policies to get installed on the DA server, on the Active Directory server, and then get repopulated back down to the Direct Access server. So it doesn't take too long in my lab here because it's just running on my laptop by itself. What I will share with you is that depending on your AD and the size and scope of your AD and the replication health of your AD, this may take a period of time, so be cautious there. Next thing you'll notice is that after that, you'll probably see some blue question marks here along with our fields. Not to worry, we just need to refresh once or twice more. And ultimately, all of those services are good. So this is the operation status in the dashboard. Obviously, we want to see green checks all the way through. So at this point, we're done with Direct Access server configuration. And so now we can actually go to our client. And I'll jump over to my client. And just before we get into deploying Direct Access on this, I actually just want to go through a couple of things. So this is my client. It's on the intranet. I have access to my intranet server. So this might be a SharePoint site or any other intranet application. So you see I can get there via single label hostname. Also, if I go to my computer, you'll see I have a mapped network drive here. I have my data and applications mapped like I normally would. So I can close all that out. Let's go over to our administrative PowerShell prompt. And here, you'll see that if I ping my domain controller, I ping it and I get a IPv4 address back and I have connectivity. So that's good. So now let's go and, so first of all, again, so the configuration for direct access for the client is deployed via group policy. So the first thing I need to do is make sure that I update my group policy here. So we'll issue a GP update dash force, if I can type correctly. Great. Also, point of interest, if you add the computer account to that Direct Access client group, you will need to restart because that's one challenge that you'll see is if you're not getting those group policy settings correctly, you may want to restart the client because, again, I've done this beforehand. But I've done this after as well before, where I've put a client in the Direct Access client group, but the client was already on and logged on, and you get frustrated because you think there's a problem there, and ultimately it's just a permissions thing. Great, so we got our group policy. So let's go ahead and make sure we have the policy correctly. So so we'll issue a GP result. And what we want to look for here is that our applied group policy objects includes the Direct Access client setting. So that means I'm good. I can also verify this by opening up the Windows Firewall with advanced settings or with advanced security console. And if I go to connection security rules, you'll see now that I have connection security rules here. This is what makes this is basically the secret sauce here. This is basically how we tell the Direct Access client to tunnel your traffic to the Direct Access server on the internet, and these are the security policies that allow you to do that. So these are fundamentally, they're basically IPsec site-to-site VPA. In this case, it's point-to-site, but that's how we're going to tunnel our traffic securely over the internet to the corpnet. So at this case, so at this point, let's take this client, and for demonstration purposes, this client has two network adapters, one that's connected to my private network, and another adapter that's on the public internet. And so I'm going to enable that client. And we should see in a moment here. That we have an IP address, so it's an IPv4 address. This is a public IPv4 address, so we're good to go there. At this point, how do we know if we're connected via direct access? We think everything was installed and configured correctly. Well, in Windows 8, and this is an improvement over Windows 7, Windows 8 includes the Network Connectivity Assistant as a part of the operating system. In Forefront UAG, you had to install an optional component called the Direct Access Connectivity Assistant to get any sort of feedback or visual indicator that you were connected to the corpnet. In this case, in Windows 8, you just hit Window key I, come over here to Networks, and you'll see my workplace connection is showing as connected. So that's telling me I have corpnet access. Well, let's go ahead and ping my domain controller, and I have connectivity. And one of the things that you'll see that's interesting here is that it did not return an IPv4 address. Why? Because it requires IPv6. It uses IPv6 end-to-end. So in this case, I have connectivity to my corpnet. It resolved dc1.lab.richarddix.com to this IPv6 address. This server, by the way, is not running IPv6. I did not install IPv6 on the domain controller. So it's talking through the DNS 6-4 and NAT 6-4 service. Now, for those of you who speak hex, I don't know if there's any developers in here, but this part of the IPv6 address is actually the IPv4 address of the domain controller in hex. So that's how it knows how to make that mapping. It's actually embedded into this IP address. So that's how the NAT 6-4 service manages those connections. So from the direct access client, I'm on the public internet. I can get to my resources in the same fashion. Remember I said familiar access. So in this case, I can still connect to my intranet resources using the same URL. Not a fully qualified domain name. I use the single label host name. The way the client works and behaves is it takes app 1, appends the DNS connection suffix, and then that matches the policy in the name resolution policy table that says to send that traffic to the DNS servers on my corpnet, right? So that's how we're able to do that. If the user's sitting in a coffee shop and they need access to their home drive, they don't have to do any sort of monkey motion. They basically can just get to their access their home drives. It's still mapped as it would be sitting at their desk. So ultimately it works. You can see that the user experience is fantastic. I didn't have to do anything other than log in, right? If I was to log out and log back in, another benefit of this solution is that I'm actually going to authenticate against a live domain controller. So that means when I hit Control-Alt-Delete on this box, my authentication is processed by a domain controller. It's not cached on the box and then tried later. It actually hits that DC. So it's a very, very secure solution. And also that reduces that pain point of when users would change their passwords on the corpnet, take their laptop home, and then log in with their old password, try to get into their resources, and then get locked out. We've been there and done that. So in terms of that, again, the user experience from the client perspective is fantastic. So let's jump back over to the direct access server itself. If we go to the operations status here, you'll see that I have the ability to look at the health of my direct access server. I want to see green checks here all the way down, but if I see a problem here, a red stop sign or the yellow little warning sign, if I were to highlight it, it would give me detailed information about what the error message is and perhaps potentially how to resolve it. So that's really helpful from a troubleshooting perspective. You'll also see that the management console includes the remote client status. This is tremendously helpful and much, much more easy to use than it was in previous versions with like Forefront UAG. It tells me the client, how it's authenticated. You can see the username and the host name as well, which transition protocol it actually used, how long it's been connected, the details in terms of some of the details as to what it's connecting to. So I can see that it's made these connections, and I can get some additional details here as well. And then reporting. Reporting is awesome. So obviously with a remote access solution, we want to know who these users are, where they're going, what they're doing, and we want to record this because we may need it for forensic purposes later. This solution does include recording. It's not accounting and reporting. It's not configured by default, so I actually have to go through and configure it. And if I select this option, configure accounting, basically what it's going to do is it's going to tell me it uses Radius for it, or it can use inbox accounting, which uses the Windows internal database. But ultimately, I can choose one or the other or both. They're not mutually exclusive, so I could log locally and to a Radius server. To use those settings, to log settings and access. And then I have, a bunch of different options here. I can select the accounting method that I want to use. I can choose how long I want to store. Run reports, much more intuitive, much better than previous solutions as well. So you have a lot of visibility there. Great. So just to finish up, I want to talk a little bit about the security considerations of this remote access solution and remote access in general. In terms of authentication, think about your password policies. We don't want to have really easy, simple passwords for any systems that are facing the internet. Most of the time, this is a global policy, unless you're using the latest Server 2012, because you can use fine-grained policies. I've worked with customers to implement fine-grained password policies for remote access users to make sure they had sufficient passwords as well. So keep that in mind. Smart cards. You can use smart cards with this solution, and you can also use dynamic passwords as well. It does support integration with OTP for Radius, so keep that in mind. Two-factor authentication is a good idea. Windows 8 clients, of course, support the TPM, and it will actually leverage that as well. From an endpoint perspective, again, enable whole disk encryption. It's foolish not to have encryption on just about any system these days. With the improvements in BitLocker in terms of performance and manageability, no reason not to deploy that to these clients, Windows 7 and Windows 8 clients. Consider using a boot pin, again, so that if the device is lost, you have some capabilities there. Keep the antivirus up to date on these remote mobile devices. And the nice thing about this solution is that I can keep them up to date. I can also monitor and make sure they're up to date and understand that if I need to push out a policy definition update, I can actually do that using Manage Out. And then from an infrastructure perspective, keep in mind that our Direct Access does support integration with NAP. So if you want to make sure that your endpoints are healthy before they connect to your corporate network over Direct Access, you can light up NAP integration and support that as well. It's important also to understand that your Direct Access clients have full access to the internet as well as your intranet by default. And so you probably want to consider a remote content filtering solution. So there are a number of different secure web gateways that support filtering of remote users. They have an on-premise plus either a cloud solution or some sort of phone home capability to apply policy. Keep that in mind. You do have the option to backhaul your internet traffic from your Direct Access clients over the IPsec tunnel, so they go through your corporate gateways. That is an option. I will tell you, it sounds good. In practice, the performance is generally poor, and the experience suffers. So if you're super, super security conscious, you may want to do that. But ultimately, I think there are better solutions. There's a lot of great cloud-based web security solutions that your clients can connect to directly over the internet, still get policy, and still be protected. And so I think those are better solutions. In addition, if a Direct Access client is ever lost or stolen, you can effectively kill it by disabling its computer account. So as soon as you kill the computer account in Active Directory, either disabled or deleted, Direct Access will fail to establish, because the IPsec tunnels are authenticated using the certificates as well as the computer account. So as soon as the computer account doesn't work, it's dead in the water. Now, a word of caution, if the client is lost or stolen and has an active session, killing the computer account will not kill the session. There's some PowerShell commands that you have to run to actually go through and look for that session and kill it. And I'll give you a URL to my website, and you can find that article there. So just kind of wrapping things up, as you can see, direct access, really, really the way to go for your remote access for your managed clients. Unfortunately, it's not a silver bullet. It's not a panacea. It's an outstanding solution for your managed remote access clients. It provides you that easy, simple experience for your users, less headache, less hassle, less help desk call, less getting up in the middle of the night to check problems with your VPN server. So it's fantastic from that perspective. In terms of compliance, and just security. Knowing your clients are managed and having that peace of mind to be able to run reports and know, hey, I have an effective patch rate of 98, 99, or 100%, and it includes my mobile clients. I know that they're patched from this particular vulnerability or zero day. Gives me just a tremendous amount of confidence. So for your managed machines, it's great. Still going to need to maintain a legacy VPN solution for non-managed clients and those types of things, but ultimately, I think direct access is an outstanding solution. So I think you will too. What I would suggest is when you get back home, start labbing it out, start deploying it. I think you really like it. Thank you, everybody, for joining me. I appreciate it. Once again, my name is Richard Hinks. Connect with me on the internet. I referred a couple of times to some articles on my website. I'm all over Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. But if you go to richardhinks.com/connect or you scan the QR code, you can connect with me there. A lot of good information. I blog on direct access as well as a couple of other things as well. And so if you want that information, you can find it there. And again, connect with me on any of the social media. You can keep up on what's going on with direct access, what's new, what's changing, how to fix and resolve things. If you have any questions, contact me. I'm always around to answer questions. So appreciate it. If you have any questions, come on up. We'll answer those one by one. And then also appreciate it. Feedback for evaluations would be tremendous. Appreciate that tremendously.